other than the Chinese, it was an apparent fact that they all were fed, they all had roofs, they all had clothes, and they even had certain spending money. I don't know where they got it. They had department stores were very abundant in Harbin and in Shanghai in particular, and in Peking there were many department stores. And you saw enormous people, an enormous amount of people there. They doing all kinds of shopping. There were toys there for children, and they're buying the toys for the children, and their shirts and that kind of thing, which was intriguing to us to see that they aren't so socialistic that they don't have that kind of interest. It's obvious that these people want to buy. They buy sweaters, or they'll buy these other kinds of nice things for their home. They also have the private property, very, very tiny. It's probably it's just probably the
a few feet, 4 feet by 4 feet or something. I saw
something
the plot
like
in the movies.
Right. Very, very small. But they get their extra money that way. It was at one point they had no private property, and then the system realized that that was rather bad, and they needed a certain amount of incentive, and so they've now allowed private property. And this is kind of a hope in my eyes, as well as witnessing their shopping in department stores, that they have a certain amount of capitalism in them, of course, and I think are going to demand an increasingly, you know, better income, a more income, and better living standards. Even though today they live much better than they did yesterday. For instance, with technology, you see, they all work. Everybody works. There wasn't a soul that was not working, including children. Children do factory work. We went to a school in which 4-year-olds had, with tremendous dexterity, we really undermine our own children at such an early age. At 4 years old, they were taking eyedroppers and picking up with tweezers tiny, tiny cork-like balls and stuffing the eyedroppers with these cork, the tweezers in the cork. That takes a tremendous amount of dexterity to do that. I mean, I was learning in kindergarten just to cut a straight line with scissors. It's just astounding. Now, these eyedroppers go to the factory. They do factory work an hour a week. But they are taught at an early age to love to do field work or factory work, whatever it is, you know, to help the state. You know, they have poems. They do plays, sing, all propaganda. And I use the word they use the word propaganda all the time. And in our vocabulary, it's considered a negative term. But in their term, in their thought process, it's a positive term. And they even say they have part of the PLA people who go into towns and post up propaganda. That's like posting up news. It's a very, which is something that is interesting. Because if you're trying to be negative, it was saying that it's just all a bunch of propaganda. I mean, they probably wouldn't even understand what you're talking about, really. They because they have such an overpopulation, they're able to use people in ways that we wouldn't even think of using here. And they have cleanup crews that go in and sweep up the mud huts, you know, around the mud huts. They're just really clean. The streets are clean. I mean, they can afford to waste labor doing that because they have so much labor. Labor's cheap. For instance, at Ta Ching, they have their oil fields are rather impressive for the Chinese. I think they bought some equipment from the United States, and a lot of it from Britain, but for instance, they use their labor force to do patchwork on on jackets, quilted jackets, and touching it gets very, very cold. And they have three sizes of jackets, a large, medium, and small. And over the winter, some of them become dilapidated. And so what these women do, hundreds of them, they're in these factories, and they pull them apart seam by seam, take the large sleeves, cut them down to small sleeves, you know, or and take the main part of the jacket and make a smaller jacket out of it. And then the tiny scrap of material that you see, they take it and use and make something else out of it. And it's like they re-weave the whole entire thing. They break up the material and then create a new piece of material out of, I mean, tiny threads. I'm not without any exaggeration. Every strand of thread is used. And I'm saying that not to over-describe the situation, but to describe their life literally. There are boots, and they go through a whole repair system with the boots, whatever. I mean, it's just astounding with how much they save. And they're saving millions of dollars in that way. But at the same oil field, they're burning billions of dollars of natural gas. And my father was making the point to them that, I mean, it's very admirable that they're saving millions of dollars of the little things, because in Japan, or in Hong Kong, or in Singapore, and in the Western world, I mean, Japanese would have immediately have looked at this natural gas that you know, billions of dollars worth, and used that and save billions of dollars while we might waste millions. But here, they're wasting billions and saving millions, you know. And it's such an obvious discrepancy in the system, and they admit it. And they don't deny it. They don't come right out. They did come out and agree with us after a length of time. But it was just another indication of the problems of their system, because everything works from the top. The low man in the totem pole in the United States, if you see something wrong, you report it to your superior, you try within the system to get the problem that you see alerted to by the hierarchy. But in China, if the low man on the totem pole spots a problem, there is no way that they can show any amount of dissent to the hierarchy. It's just not done. It's very difficult to disseminate information from the lower ranks to the higher ranks without getting your head chopped off. We're in a democratic system, it's one of our virtues. So the problem of wasting billions of dollars is something that goes on until someone has the courage or the political clout, enough working points, you know, that can talk to the hierarchy and say, look what we're doing. We're wasting lots of money here. My father quoted a statement out of Chairman Mao's book, saying something like, I've forgotten the exact quote, but to the effect that waste not, everything is extremely important to utilize and save. And he quoted that in exact words to Madame Kong and then pointed to the natural gas that they are wasting and saying, isn't this in direct violation to your, you know, political dogma? So of course there was a certain amount of embarrassment, and she kind of went after to understand all the we really pressed him about their propaganda. And she kind of laughed a little bit and, you know, was obviously, she protected herself in a very diplomatic way. But
were they impressed that your dad obviously had a working knowledge of Chairman Mao's?
Oh yes. Oh yes. And my father calculated in his head how many billions, exactly how many billions of dollars that they were wasting. Well, they wouldn't tell us how many oil fields they have. They wouldn't tell us a lot of information that we asked, okay? But we asked, and we asked all kinds of questions to try to get around it, but we are able to, and other information, we're able to, my father was able to calculate how many dollars worth, how many billions of dollars worth that they were wasting, you know, a year. And these Chinese were like, where'd you get that figure, you know? they were amazed, you know, I mean, here they're trying to hide all this information from us, you know? But my father came up with it, and when my father went back to the CIA, he had reported how many billions of dollars that he calculated in his head, and my father was really approximately, you know, he was like $2 or $3 billion off, you know? But they were astounded. Where in the world did they get this his figure, you know? We just said he's a very smart man. Of course, they can't believe it. I mean, they believe it, but they can't believe that that's how he got it, was into his own head. There must have been other ways in which he had gotten it.
So they probably figured that Stansfield turning the CIA has the information and gave it to him.
My father really enjoyed playing the game with him, though. It was really funny. Because he was sitting in the train, he was in his stupor again, when my dad thinks he goes off and in the never-never world. And so I asked him what he was thinking about. He was thinking, because if I was the chairman of China, how I would invade Taiwan. It was so funny, you know. But we were on the train. We went to one factory where they produced trains, it was very impressive, rather, and they were very pleased with their work. And so during the time in which we were allowed to ask questions, my father said in a very serious way, but he was really trying to be, he has a way of being needling them in a way. And he said, "Now tell me, do these trains fit the tracks and the train tracks in Taiwan?" And they go, "All these trains can be adjusted to fit the tracks anywhere in the world."
Did they appreciate that sense of humor, though?
Oh, I think they did. I think they did. You know, Madame Khan really laughed, that is kind of a funny question.
When you were in Shanghai, your mother was telling me that the mayor of Shanghai asked her the good things and the bad things that she had witnessed, mm-hmm. During your trip through China.
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember what she said and what his reaction was?
Well, she was fairly emotional, and she said that she said, "You asked, and so I'll be very honest with you. There were many things that she did not like." She began to recite them, and she talked about her mother's grave, the cemetery, the way they disposed of all that, the way they're not able to upkeep their apartments, and the people don't have a sanitary consciousness about it. It's just terrible sanitary ways. It's just, for me, my mother is talking about a world in which she's talking about civilized, or a civilization that has reached a point in their culture that they can now have the luxury to think about sanitary conditions, or think about luxurious things, luxurious is an inaccurate word, but think about other things. They're still developing. They're still poor, and they admit that all the time. She was very, very fair with them and very honest, and many of her points were well taken. And then she gave some of the plates, then she told them some of the good things. It's obvious that everybody can eat and are very well provided for, with homes and clothes, and have meaning in their life in the sense that they all work. The handicapped work. Handicapped aren't doing some menial tasks, but they're utilized. There's meaning in their life for the state. As I said, wherever I went, like Madame Kong, without a doubt, is very dedicated to her system, and I think she sees that there's some flaws in it. And whenever we would point out the flaws, and I'm sure she agreed with us, I could just tell in her heart, she would deliver the party line again, which is just a convenient way of answering a question without answering it.
It's almost like the Hare Krishna we were talking about. The program answer.
Right.
What were the impressions that you had when you had the opportunity to visit a commune?
Impressions?
You visited a commune that had been around for a while. Didn't you visit also a model commune?
We visited a model commune in Peking. It was regurgitating. It's the same place the Fords have gone to. It's the same place that the Nixons have probably gone to. And it's just, not at all what it's like. I mean, it's all They live very, very well. But we had passed many communes that were very, very poor. But when they showed us a home in the commune. Like obviously, the hostess of the home greeted us with extreme delight and told how great the system is and how wonderful life is now as opposed to the life that my grandmother lived. And, you know, all this kind of thing. When we walked into her home, her grandmother was sitting there, whose feet were obviously bound, very, very tiny. You know, they just kind of shuffle on the ground. There were a lot of women that we saw, you know, that had bound feet. And all the young wear their communist costumes, but the older women, although there are few of them, but the older women still make their own Chinese, the old top, the one that the Chinese buttons, comes across the Chinese collar. But it's the older people.
Julie Nixon Eisenhower, in her book, Special People, was talking about Mao Zedong and her trip to China with her husband. And she mentioned that she was constantly aware that their room was bugged. That that she could not say anything to David without it being recorded.
Uh-huh.
Did you just come to realize that would be the case and just accept it? Were you constantly aware that everything that you said was being taped?
Well, yes, but that was unfamiliar to us because wherever we traveled, when Dad was CNO, you know, we were always briefed that wherever we stayed, it was bugged. And so, you know, China was an obvious fact that we didn't need to be reminded of it. But, sometimes we would deliberately make jokes and we'd go, take that, you bug, you know. Or report this to your chairman. Well, you've got
but your dad
you crummy orange drink.
Could your dad do that too?
Well, we were 7 days in Peking, the first 7 days. Every minute we were given the propaganda. I mean, I cannot tell you what it was like. You really have to be there to experience it. It was as though you were in a closet and the recording was on, it was turned on, and every minute was propaganda. Every single minute. And it would get louder and it would get far more, you know, vocal and profound. And
on a speaker in your room? Or
no, these people. I mean, wherever you went, there was always, you know, but, in, you know, it was, I mean, our interpreters were giving us the propaganda, the lecturers were giving the propaganda, the speakers were on, too. You could hear the propaganda. You'd get up 6 o'clock in the morning and the speakers were on, you know. The radio was propaganda. Wherever you looked, there were pictures of Chairman Mao and Chairman Wall. And then the first 7 days that we were there, by the seventh day, we had a choice. We wanted to go see a movie, or if we wanted to retire, we'd stay. I got sick of it. Everybody went, but I. I told them, I said, I just can't stand. I just can't take it anymore. I mean, it was just so fouled up. It was. I mean, I cannot tell you the intensity of how much they tried to indoctrinate or drill you with their propaganda in the beginning. Now that became less and less of that as we continued in our trip.
Like you said, it's everything. It's the movies. The radio, it's the books. Everywhere. I even saw the children's books that Musetta got for your niece. Incredible.
You know, the performances were how, you know, PLA, and it was just, it was to the point that you, if they were trying to convince us about how virtuous this system was, the way you do it is you don't make the mistake of doing it their way, you try to do it our way. You know what I mean? In other words, to convert somebody to Christianity, you come to them and you do it according to their culture, but you don't ask them to adjust to you. You know what I mean? You understand them. Well, it was the same thing here. Instead, they were turning us off. They're making us resentful to them, you know? And so, we just really poked fun at, I mean, in a polite, dignified fashion. I mean, as I said, we weren't so cutting to the point that we offended them or were rude, but obviously, they knew and we knew that they had their ideological beliefs and we had our ideological beliefs, you know, and we weren't going to change. And they enjoyed us. They learned a lot from us, and I know they really did like us.
You know, they're constantly talking about equality, okay? You were given the VIP treatment. Did you see inequality in the way that the higher echelon, the party leaders, the military leaders were living, and the way that the common laborer was living?
The high echelon people, for instance, the chairman and the vice premier and so on and so forth, were obviously giving better homes and the help and all that. But the other people whom we, like Nancy Kang, okay, that kind of person who is not necessarily as important as those others, they would probably live in a home that was a little better than the others, and they probably had the advantage of not living with living with another family in their home. But other than that, I mean, they didn't have cars, they all had bikes, and they all had the same work, and they all underwent the same kind of family separation. You did not get the pronounced class difference as you did, for instance, in Iran. You knew the elite, and you knew those who were not the elite. And
it's much more pronounced in Iran than it even is in the United States. There's such a difference between those who have and those who don't. You mentioned to me that the people in Iran, for example, were like your typical jet setters. And Mozetta said, you know, the Yves Saint Laurent, you know, eyeglasses,
yes,
and the Pierre Cardin.
But we still have that. There's still that here. Who's the same?
You mentioned, what's her name, Nancy Tang?
Tang.
What were your impressions of her?
She's a very bright person. And that she... I would expect to see her in some important position someday. She's no longer an interpreter. She had been with us on the first night and had... it was very beneficial to have her there because sometimes our jokes were difficult to understand and she would translate the correct meaning. So I'm trying to... Yeah, she's now the deputy director of the American and Oceania Department of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So she's, you know, definitely climbing.
And how old a woman is she?
32, 33, something like that. She's not married. It's feeling that she's a hard person. My father, it was debated, we were arguing about this. For instance, if there was a certain person that we really liked, and we said to ourselves, maybe didn't believe in the party line so much, when we knew the bug was wrong, we'd go, oh, he was really tricky, and boy, does he really believe in the party line, you know. Those people who we knew really believed in the party line, you know, we'd go, I'm not so sure if he really believes in the party line.
Did you do that to Nancy Tang?
Oh, I can't, you know, I think that sometimes we would forget that the bugs were on, and we would immediately patch it up. I think they were very confused with the way we were talking, because there's a lot of, you know, when you're sitting there, there's a lot of eye contact, and you all are, you know, waving your eyes and saying this is a joke, and then they're all emphasizing on it, and so it's just kind of, we were playing around. But my father doesn't think that she really believes in the system as much as she vocalized. She's very vocal, and she's very strong, and you get the impression that she does not budge. But my dad got the impression that she just is not, he thinks that that's a front. Now, I don't believe that. I think she really does believe in it. So it's interesting. I have no idea. My father's a poor judge of character oftentimes. You know? But my father has a hard time believing that anybody believes in that system, you know?
Yeah.
Well, he was just...
I was interested in her because I read Julie Nix Eisenhower mentions her as their interpreter when she and David Eisenhower were in China.
Now, one thing about Nancy Tang is she's disinterested in people. She really isn't. She's very interested in the affairs of the state, but in terms of people, I don't get the impression she likes people. Whereas Madame Kang was somebody who had tremendous sincerity, and I got the impression she really does like people, and she wants to see their betterment. and I'm sure Nancy Tang does too, but we're just trying to give you the flavor, the two different people.
And the party hierarchy.
Madame, when I left, I felt as though Madame Kong had taught me something. Even though she's of a totally different thought than I.
But she was, because she was so human and she had feelings, you could...
Yes, but there are people who are human and feelings and you still don't learn from them. But this woman I felt as though was wise.